Serious Universe, Season 32, Episode 6. Coming up on the show, we've got the mechanized monster technology, the Diamond Saucer breakthrough, and the story of the world's greatest art thief. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Who is this art thief?
He's a bit of a loser.
How can you be the world's greatest art thief and also be a loser at the same time?
I've got him on the screen. There he is. Meet Stefan. Stefan, yeah, a bit of a loser. He's a French guy.
That explains it.
Yeah, no, there's more than that. There's more reasons than that. In the late 90s, Stefan was unemployed. He was broke, had no friends. He lived in his mother's attic.
Okay, he's a loser.
He had no real solid prospects for the future. The only thing he had going for him, he did have a girlfriend. He had this girlfriend. Okay. And apart from, yeah, Anne Catherine was his girlfriend.
It's not like a DMT sex doll girlfriend like in the Last Plus episode.
No, like a real
girlfriend. Oh.
The only thing he had going for him is when he would wake up in the morning, the first thing he would see next to his bed, on his bedside table, was worth $4 million. And it was
it's obviously
carving,
an object of art.
A carving of Adam and Eve. And then he'd look over past that and he would see like a painting on the wall and that's worth $5 million. And he'd slowly look around his room and realize that he had $2 billion worth of art in his bedroom in his mother's attic in this dingy little town in France.
How did his mother and girlfriend not question him about that?
The funniest thing about the story is, well, his girlfriend knew, but the funniest thing about the story I'll be telling later on in the show is he just told his mother that he was bringing home bric-a-brac, like antiques from the local store, or he bought it from a flea market, and she'd be like, oh, another crossbow, honey. Oh, that's three you've got now.
Well, how often? Another,
that looks like a Rembrandt. I guess you just picked up one from the local flea market.
She must have known on some level. Well, although in saying that, like you talk about shows like, is it Antiques Roadshow? The number of times you've got some old duck that bought something from a, you know, an op shop yeah. and it's worth, you know, thousands of dollars. So maybe.
It's a really fascinating story. It's from a book that came out last year. It's actually a bestseller. It's from Michael Finkel. I'll put it up on the screen here. The Art Thief. A true story of love, crime, and a dangerous obsession. I've had it in my library for a little while. I bought the Kindle edition today. I've got a soft copy at home. But I decided to read it this week, and it is an incredible story, an unbelievable story. The most MU side of it, the most mysterious paranormal part of it, is when he looks at art, and it's not any art. It's got to be a very specific type of art, like Renaissance masters from, you know, the 16th century or something. When he looks at a particular type of art that strikes him, he gets this physiological reaction to it.
Oh, he's a psychometrist.
No, it's not psychometry. He gets overtaken with this electric feeling that bursts up his spine. He says he feels the art in his fingertips. He gets this like feeling radiating throughout his body, and he just has to have that piece of art. He has to take it. He has to get it somehow.
So he's
just captured by it.
What, there's some hidden addictive energy? Like, does it actually go beyond an addiction? There is something that seems to be supernatural about it?
Yes, I'll talk about this later on in the episode, perhaps in our Plus extension, but there's a specific name for this, and it escapes me now, but it was first written about, I think, in the 17th century by someone who was in Florence, and he went and he was looking at one of the frescoes in one of the little churches there. He was looking at the paintings on the ceiling, and just overcome with not like an ecstatic vision or anything, but this physiological reaction to the art where he felt like his eyeballs were going to burst. Like literally, he thought like his head was going to explode.
How
and
bizarre.
He went running from the church and like splayed out on the bench and just had to recover. Like it took him 20 minutes to recover. And he wrote about this. And years later, like centuries later, this is just a recent kind of documented thing. There's a psychologist in, I think he's in France, or maybe an Italian psychologist, who discovered that this was a real syndrome, that there were people, and primarily happens in Florence, but it also happens in Paris, other places that have beautiful, historic, typically Renaissance art.
Well, which were hotspots for the Renaissance.
Where they think their head's going to explode from looking at it.
So,
and it's got, they named the syndrome after this guy, and I wish I had the notes in front of me. They're not in front of me, but It's basically, yeah, this feeling where you feel like you're being overtaken. Some people feel like they're going to die, and the only way to recover from it is to stop looking at art.
So it's like an art-induced panic attack?
Kind of, yeah. Like they feel like their chest is going to explode and their eyeballs are going to fall out and they're just going to collapse and die from... And it's not, it's like a beautiful thing. Like they're looking at something beautiful
and
magnificent.
So it's like an ecstasy.
Yeah, but they can't hold it in. They feel like they're going to burst and explode.
That's intriguing, because isn't the whole point of art? Like the whole point of art is supposed to induce feelings, you know, whether it's supposed to be good feelings, bad feelings, you know, revulsion, all these sorts of things. Like art is designed to induce those feelings, but something that would be so extreme and so bold is clearly unusual.
I found the notes here. It's from the French writer Stendhal, and he wrote this in his 1817 travel log when he was in Florence. But it was in the 1970s, the chief psychiatrist at Florence's Central Hospital, Margherini, his name was, he found 100 cases. And the symptoms are typically people overwhelmed by art. They would experience dizziness, heart palpitations, memory loss. One person said she felt as if her eyeballs had grown fingertips. And yeah, he said the only way to get past it and not have a relapse was stop looking at art. You have to stop looking at it. So isn't that strange?
I've never heard anything like that. It's like a form of, it sounds like synesthesia, but it can't be that. Maybe it's along those lines, yeah.
So this guy I'll be talking about, this French guy, Stefan, he had this Stendhal syndrome, but he was also a master thief.
So he was also a kleptomaniac. Is that how? Is it like a? Does it sit somewhere on the anxiety spectrum or something? It's like he could only treat it by stealing it.
See, his critics say he was a kleptomaniac, which means that you're addicted to stealing.
Yep.
But he didn't really care about the stealing. He cared about the art. See, a kleptomaniac, they don't care what they steal.
Oh,
it's just the act of stealing.
Right.
Like you know, it's like people addicted to shoplifting. They'll just steal whatever, even if they don't need it, because they're addicted to it. But he didn't have that. He actually really cared about specific items because he would get that feeling, the Stendhal syndrome. He would get that zap and then he would like, I have to get it, even if it requires.
Say no more. I'm looking forward to that coming up a little bit later in the show.
What have you got?
So, well, I want to jump into Terrestrial Trespasses, The Greys, Abductions and Areas of High Strangeness. This is by Philip Kinsella. Really fascinating guy. You may recall
I bought that this week as well.
Well, there you go. I touched on one of his books previously. I was talking about Sky Crash, Throughout Time, UFOs, The Reptilian Man, and Strange Mysteries Surrounding Rendlesham. And it's rather just coincidental, Ben, that you sent me an article today which actually ties into Rendlesham itself. And much of his book does touch on these areas of high strangeness, and it actually describes his personal experiences, which is so typical for anyone that's talking about these sorts of stories. But on the Last Plus show, you know, I was talking about these outsider abduction cases. You know, I'd suggested, look, for the most part, UFO abductions for, you know, modern UFO abductions, they tend to follow the same MO. You know, we know exactly what's going to happen. You wake up in the light, you find yourself being dragged out of the house by greys or through something by greys. You find yourself on a metal table, you black out, something shoved in you, and then you're back in the house,
yes,
right?
Something shoved in you, yes.
Pretty much that, right? Now, Philip's experience is similar, but it actually is one of these outlying cases where it has all these extreme elements of high strangeness, some of the most unusual elements of an abduction scenario that I've ever uncovered. And I looked, and it turns out that Philip is also a psychic medium. So I thought, that must play a role in what's going on here. But he actually has a very intriguing hypothesis as to what this alien intelligence may be doing, something that I hadn't considered before, but he calls it the corridor, right? So keep that
what's
in mind.
The corridor?
I'll come back to the corridor, but essentially there's something known as the corridor.
Is that where they do the insertions in the corridor?
Well, basically, no. Well, there is a form of insertion, but not that kind of insertion. But the greys have gotten into that corridor, which means they've basically got direct access to humanity in a way that I hadn't really considered before. So I like his approach. But before we jump into his book and I start describing his experiences, I wanted to bring you this headline. It's from The Express. So look, you know, we'll just take it with a grain of salt, but it comes from The Express and it's UFO breakthrough as two of UK's most famous cases finally solved. This is by John Austin. And look, it's not solved by any means at all.
This is Rendlesham, right?
This links into Rendlesham. It relates to something very intriguing, a couple of photographs, or six photographs, in fact, that were captured back by two hikers on August 4th in 1990. It writes, a British UFO researcher claims to have solved one of the UK's most intriguing UFO mysteries 34 years after it was spectacularly captured on film. Now, Ben, if you just bring up the images that I've given you, if you bring up image number one from our picture library.
That's the one famous. No,
so what this one is, this is a recreation. So this has been basically, it's not AI, but it is like an artist's recreation of what was taken. So six staggering photographs were taken by two hikers on August the 4th in 1999. It's said to show an odd diamond-shaped
object. This is the
object.
Original, right?
This is the original.
So it looks like a diamond with a military plane in pursuit.
Yeah.
Just over a field somewhere.
Yep.
In the UK.
Well, apparently this object, the hikers claim, was being tailed by at least one and possibly two Harrier jets, like, you know, those jump jet kind of things. You know, 1990 was very fitting for the time of what type of standard aircraft we had. But the diamond aircraft, this UFO, is not standard by any means at all. Now, around the time, the newspaper, all these hikers, I'm sorry, they handed the photographs to the Scottish Daily Record, and they were going to write a story about it and publish it. Now, the newspaper, for whatever reason, I don't know if they did it with permission or not, but handed their prints and the negatives over to the Ministry of Defence for comment. Now, they claim that they returned them, but bizarrely, the story was never published by the newspaper, and the images and the negatives also disappeared.
It looks like they've hired my three-year-old for the sketches of the event.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. That's not really important as to what's going on. The photograph is actually more spectacular. I mean, if this is real. Now, the story became public in 1996. It's been around for a little while because Nick Pope, of course, you know, Nick Pope is well known in the UFO field. He's a former Ministry of Defence civil servant. He obviously investigates UFO phenomenon. He wrote an unclassified version of this in his book, Open Skies, Closed Minds. Now, he stated that he had a copy of the photo that was placed on his office wall at the Ministry of Defence, but was later removed by his superiors. Now, is it just because you're not supposed to? Yeah, I mean, it's a bit
Isn't
weird.
He supposed to be investigating UFOs? And they're like, you can't have that on the wall.
Well, maybe. I mean, it's a bit interesting, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, was
his job, right?
Was that his job?
He was at the Ministry of Defence.
I think he was like a liaison or something, wasn't he? So, yeah, it would make sense that you would have that. So why would they take it down? Well, in August of 2020, a retired RAF press officer by the name of Craig Lindsay revealed what he believes to be one of the original photos that was given to the press. And there's a handwritten note on the back, and it actually names the photographer.
Yeah, he literally worked at the UFO desk, 1991 to 1994.
Well, there you go.
He was the Secretariat Air Staff Section AS2A, the UFO desk. Again, that's like having your job on the wall at your job.
Well, it may be, if this is true, what's being reported here, and again, I said we just have to tread lightly about this, but it may actually be because this is not an extraterrestrial craft at all. This is not what I believe, you know, and this is why governments do things, right? They let people kind of look at what's really the the distraction.
And that's why the plane was in pursuit. It's really just monitoring this
or
escorting this advanced aircraft.
Yep. So apparently the image has been analysed the photographer's name I should get out of the way first. His name is Kevin Russell, but unfortunately attempts to trace him have proved fruitless. So no one knows who this guy is. Who knows? It could be a pseudonym. But the image was analysed by Andrew Robinson, who was a senior lecturer at Sheffield Hallam University.
You got a licence for that UFO photo, mate?
Well, someone posted
You got
online
a licence for that photo?
Yeah, and they were arrested for a white supremacy 2 minutes later after posting it.
We can't talk. Our country's just as bad.
Oh, I know. I know. Our opposition leader just said that if you know of anyone who's talking about any anti-government ideas, that you have to dob us in. I mean, not us, but just in general.
Mate, do you have a licence for that UFO podcast?
Dob people into ASIO, our Australian Secret Intelligence Organisation.
I've already dobbed you in three times. They stopped receiving my calls. They were like, can you please stop calling us? I'm like, this guy, Aaron Wright, you have got to get him.
I've been dobbing you in for years.
He's got me doing this podcast and I can't get out of it. I've been doing it for 17 years.
You know what? I just gave him our Telegram history. You're done, mate. You're fucked. So anyway, I'm going back to this.
All of those swastikas were satire.
So the question no one has been able to answer is, what is this diamond-shaped craft and why is there a military jet following it? Now, a UFO researcher and filmmaker by the name of Mark Christopher Lee, he believes he's solved the mystery. This is where the headline comes, that it's solved. Mr. Lee has said, luckily, I've recently had access to a retired CID officer by the name of John Hansen. He has a UFO archive at Stratford-upon-Avon. This is essentially a treasure trove of UFO sightings going back to the 1940s. So it must be huge. It must be a very considerable library. He says, from going through all these documents, there seems to be a lot of sightings of diamond-shaped craft since the 1970s, right? And this is where we do get answers, I think, with a lot of this stuff, is when you do have researchers, whether it's years or decades later, that start plotting this stuff somehow. And I'm talking, you know, both literally and figuratively. But if you look and you go, oh, hang on a second, in that just like from the 1970s, all of a sudden, a bunch of diamond-shaped craft are showing up all around the UK, but they're in hotspots, and those hotspots happen to be directly around military installations.
Well, we did speak about that so-called whistleblower on the last Plus show.
Yes.
It came out at the start of the year in response to Grosh and anonymously, so whatever, yeah. But anonymously claimed he was part of a retrieval program.
Yes.
And they Americans were working closely with Europe with crash craft. And it was so intriguing because he said that often these craft would land or crash. But if they landed intact, there were some cases where they just didn't take off again.
Yeah.
And there was no one on board.
The seeding.
It's almost like,
technology.
Here you go.
This
Here's a
enough,
flying saucer.
And obviously this book was published well before this information came out. This book was published over a year ago. But Kinsella's book does touch on this idea that these craft have been purposely placed here for whatever reason. It's to... And at my time, something that you said, Ben, you know, you threw this kind of this anecdote in there that there is some suggestion amongst, you know, certain spiritual people that humanity is deliberately being influenced so that we kind of fit the code of whatever the aliens use. So they seem to be very much stuck in, what was it, a code or some kind, like a computer code. And that's why humans are trying to be forced into this, why we have so much technology and video games and all this kind of stuff. It's because we're supposed to fit into their code.
Well, it's the idea is you seed a civilization with your own technology so that when you're ready,
well, you're
your home is already furnished, put
yeah.
it that way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a precursor to invasion. But he says, look, from these archives, there is a sighting from April of 1978 where an Essex girl called Janet Bull reported seeing a diamond-shaped UFO being chased by two RAF jets. So I was like, oh, okay, 78. This is 1990. But again... there seems to be this theme, and there's multiple reports of this, of these craft being escorted by two jet craft. I'm like, yeah, is that what's going on? Because you'd have, obviously, a craft to escort, then you have a backup one. Is that the why you know they're following this particular methodology? 1979, you've got Brett Lynn. He's a police officer serving at RAF in Norfolk. He said that at 7 a.m., I just unlocked the padlock when there was a terrible loud boom directly over my head. I instinctively flinched down and then looked up into the sky where the noise had come from. There were now intermittent clouds, but moving between two of them was a very large diamond-shaped craft. Once again, he said it was certainly several times bigger than any aircraft I've ever seen before, and its shape was nothing like I had seen. The whole underside of the craft was covered in equally spaced sets of diamond-patterned lights. Several of the lights were in different colours.
How does this link to Rendlesham?
Okay, so stick with me on this one. So he said that the craft, there was reds, orange, purples, greens, and yellows, but they were all in groups of the same color. And there was no noise at all as this craft moved silently across the sky. Now, Mr. Hansard wonders if there could have been a connection between Mr. Lynn's 1979 sighting and the subsequent 1980 Rendlesham UFO case that has been dubbed the British Roswell. And if you recall with what happened in Rendlesham, what style of craft was it? It was a diamond-shaped craft.
That's right.
And this was just outside of RAF Bentwaters, the base. And this mysterious event took place over several days. There's a lot of controversy as to what went on there. If you're not familiar, I mean, you should be familiar with this case, but if you're not, I'll link to an article in the show notes which describes it. Really, all you need to know is that you had a bunch of military men that encountered this diamond-shaped craft. Later on, the story has kind of filled out to describe that some people said that they were telepathically connected to the craft. Others said that when they touched the craft that had these strange hieroglyphics, those same hieroglyphics came up inside their mind. All these elements of high strangeness fitting in with this case.
I was just bringing up this one from Ibiza last week. It's supposed to be really impressive. Wait for it. Nothing.
And this is the problem, though, that we still have. It's like... I noticed there's a number of skeptics that go, oh, everyone's got a mobile phone camera now. How come you don't catch anything? Like, you don't understand how difficult it is to capture these things, first of all, because of the speed they're moving at, but also the distance. Like, every single time, it's just a speck in the sky. Like, unless the thing's floating over the... Yeah, exactly. I mean, unless the thing's floating over the top of you, which is very rare. And on top of that as well, Because the
you can't say anything until you feel the insertion in the corridor.
That's right.
Anything before that is pure speculation. That's you need to be in that corridor.
So he writes here that there was a sighting actually prior to Rendlesham by two men standing on the seafront in Suffolk, about 20 miles from a RAF base, when they sighted what appeared to have been a diamond-shaped craft fly over the coast. And of course, this craft was also silent. Then on the 25th of October,
a bunch of diamond crafts. What's the big story? He reckons he solved it, right?
Yeah, well, he reckons this is what it is. He thinks that what this actually is that these are experimental aircraft being, utilized by the MOD.
Wow. What an incredibly novel revelation.
I'm like, what an incredible. Okay.
No one's ever thought of this before. This is the first time anyone's ever come up with this idea. What a novel idea.
Well,
that this is, imagine this. This is a reverse engineered spacecraft. Oh, color me shocked.
Well, but it is fascinating. Like, I will agree that it's fascinating that you basically have from the 1970s, these things kind of took off. It's like, well, is it because that's when they were ready? Like, that's when they'd engineered them. That's when they were ready to test them. Where this particular photograph was taken, it just happens to be only 100 miles from a secretive RAF base that was at on the Kintyre Peninsula. And this is also the location where the US spy plane Aurora was rumored to be operating around the same time.
Maybe the aliens have reverse engineered the F4 Phantom.
Yeah, well,
and what you're actually seeing there is not a human plane. It's a reverse engineered alien.
Well, I mean, you joke, but we have heard stories of shape-shifting craft mimicking, basically standard aircraft. So maybe there's something going on there. The last thing I'll say is that last month, a chef by the name of Richard Grieve said that he'd worked with two hikers who had actually taken the picture at a hotel in Calvine. So when he spoke to them, because they came back apparently and they were extremely disturbed by what they had seen after taking the photograph, this chef, Richard, he says that after the sighting, a dark car pulled up at the pub house where they were, or the publican house. Two men dressed in black suits emerged to have a chat with the two men. Both men were visibly shaken by the approach of the men, and they refused to turn up to work afterwards, becoming heavy drinkers, and then they disappeared, never to be heard from again.
Yeah, we spoke about that case a couple weeks ago.
So is it suggesting that, this is just simply, it's not extraterrestrial, even though that's got a Men in Black feel to it. I don't think these are the Keelian Men in Black. This just sounds like they are government Men in Black, that, these guys have photographed this aircraft. But then, how would they know that they'd photographed it? Because it wasn't until well afterwards that they handed the documents to a newspaper. So, look, questions are left behind. Who knows what's going on here? I think the suggestion, though, that it's a breakthrough of the cases finally being solved, I don't think that's the answer at all. But, any of these details are good anyway to be discussed. But let's jump now into Philip Kinsella's book, and I'll start describing some of the experiences he's undergone. This is Terrestrial Trespasses, The Greys, Abductions, and Areas of High Strangeness. And basically, it starts off in this really fascinating way, in the sense that, look, he says, we've spent decades of searching and we're no nearer to understanding what we're really up against. And he says his own harrowing experience back in the winter of 1989 with seemingly non-human entities absolutely destroyed him. It terrified him. It traumatized him. Essentially, he was sexually assaulted by these things. It's a truly horrible experience. And coupled with this was the fact that back in 1989, it's a very different world there. I mean, I know it's a different world in a number of senses, obviously, because time has passed. But the difference is here, I think if people are willing to talk about the UFO abductions, even though there's still stigma and ridicule attached to it, I think people are more open-minded to, engage with this. And of course, you have the internet now, so you can find support groups. He said no one wanted to talk about this back in the day. No one wanted to know about UFOs, alien abductions. And because of this, I suffered a barrage of ridicule and scorn, along with a considerable amount of shame. And this book is not only a re-examination of those events for him, but also what unexpectedly transpired within his life, and a deeper investigation into the rawness and disturbing elements surrounding what occurred to him. He says, we have to wade into uncomfortable territory in our search for the truth to see what can be truly understood of this anomalous spectacle, because it really is. And he says, we have to highlight the truly complex nature of the phenomenon. This is something that we try to do on the show here. I don't like pigeonholing stories. I like to find that there's an interconnected nature to this phenomenon. It's not just people seeing lights in the sky. It's not just people experiencing ghosts. It's not just people having out-of-body experiences. When you look at some of these cases, you find that there are connections between each. You find that, when someone comes forward, And that because they're so scared of the ridicule, they're initially reluctant to even say, well, I was abducted by aliens. But when they start talking to other people in the field, they go, oh, I also had this experience when I was young. I also had this strange experience.
So what makes Kinsella's experiences stand out from the usual pattern?
Well, he said the events as they unfolded during that cold winter's snatching in the early hours of the morning are something that are very difficult to explain. But of course, you know, he said he has a twin. Immediately, I'm just like, okay, here we go.
So is the twin abducted as well? What's going on there?
Yeah. There's okay. But it's not in this same incident, right? So first of all, he highlights that he was 20 years old. He lived in a small village of Marston Mortain, which is roughly 5 miles outside the town of Bedford. He said, my twin and I shared a large bedroom downstairs within a cul-de-sac. You know, it was a nice house, a nice area. There wasn't anything that would be, pardon me, indicating that there could be strange things going on, except, of course, for the fact that he had witnessed so-called UFOs in his younger days. Although he writes that I'd never felt that they'd been important enough to document them because to my mind, that seemed so far removed from my reality and people just wouldn't understand. And he says, I'd been bullied and jeered at by other students for stating that I'd seen a UFO outside my back garden at night, which had come low and hovered over their garden shed. Now, in this particular incident, he was 11 years old and he had seen this red fiery object, as he writes there, floating over his garden shed. He got really excited when he saw this thing. It was almost like this thing was in a way mocking him. But he goes and tells his mother, like he gets his mother off the phone and his mother comes running over. He's like, mom, you've got to see this. You've got to see this. And of course, what happens in these cases, she comes to the window. It's this large picture window where you can see everything outside and there's nothing there. And while she may have just hung up the phone or maybe just put it to the side, but she's like, you've just seen a plane and then let it go. But of course, he says that sometime before this, like only, you know, an hour or so maybe before this, he and Ronnie, his twin brother, had actually been in their bedroom laughing and joking about aliens and UFOs, saying how ridiculous the entire thing was. So he writes that the experience felt personal, which is very much what this stuff is. For whatever reason, there does seem to be a personal nature to it. It was as though some invisible force that was now, trying to get him to change his negative attitude towards the phenomenon. And he says, the big mistake I made was telling people at school because I'd become a laughingstock. So skip forward 9 years to where he's 20 years old. It's a winter's night in 1989. He's coming home from work. It's been a long day. It's freezing. And he says, all I need to do is just get a cup of coffee and get into the house. Now he goes inside the house and his twin brother is there. His sister is there. And when he goes inside, he kind of just says hi to them and everything seems to be okay. But then the atmosphere, he says, begins to fluctuate. This is the term he used. It became charged. It became so charged to the point where he felt the hairs on his arm starting to raise up like this static electricity kind of flowing in and flooding in all through the house. Now, Benji, his dog, begins to growl. And this growl is just unlike what his dog would do. It's very strange. And he says, as I recall the events, I must stress that everything happened within the space of a few minutes. Like it's only minutes that this takes place. But for whatever reason, it feels like it had taken so much longer. And he says, I'd noticed that my brother, who had been standing to my far left and kind of away from the door, suddenly raised his head up to the ceiling. It's like he just was like on autopilot somehow. His stance stiffened, like he was being paralyzed in some way. His mouth starts to open in a slow motion and these words start spilling out of his mouth like they're not his words. They're coming from something else. And what he spoke about both alarmed and confused me. Kinsella writes, the words are, there's going to be an earthquake or grandma's going to die.
What?
And it's like,
or does he have to choose?
It's just weird because he's like, there's no earthquake and our maternal grandmother had still been very much alive up to this point. And as my brother spoke those strange words, the dog became more frantic and I see a light coming directly up from our driveway. Like this light just suddenly starts appearing. And he says, what was equally bizarre was that I was now observing something that completely defied physics. This bright white light, which was outside, somehow in a way became physical. He said the light impressed itself around the door and started to apply pressure to the framework, which started to bend right in front of him. He said even the glass was bending, but not from what my interpretation is, not in the sense of like if you were to try and bend a pane of glass, it might have a certain amount of give in it, but ultimately it's going to break. It was more like the molecular structure of it started to actually bend and warp and change as a result of this impact from this solid light. Now, over the years, we've described people encountering solid lights connected with UFO encounters. You know, people say that the light is not a light in the sense that we know. Like, if we get struck by light,
it's more like a plasma or something.
But in some circumstances, it's actually solid. Like, people said that they've been, you know, hit and pushed over by these lights. They've actually been able to grab hold. It's like a tube coming down as opposed to a light, but it just looks like a light. And then the physicality of it can just suddenly evaporate. Like, it just suddenly changes. It's like they have this control over physics, which makes sense. I mean, what potentially they're describing here is maybe what we would call a tractor beam. I mean, that's all. But he says, as he sees the door frame start to warp, it's almost like there's a portal or something that starts to open within this. And he says, running through the glass is this creature. The creature is just completely invisible, impervious to the glass. Permeable, right? The creature just runs through the glass. He said, it's this black-clad, small thing, like 3 foot tall, but black-clad.
Black Ops Greys.
It's pretty much Black Ops Greys. Mm-hmm. Right? This thing runs into the house. He's watching and he says it disappears into our bedroom. This is he and his twin brother's bedroom. And he says in an instant, the door and everything else around it returned to complete normality, whatever that was. And this thing had vanished. Benji's barking and frightened manner indicated that we now had an intruder in the house, but this was one of a very different kind. So of course, you know, after seeing something like this, he just completely freaks out. And he's like, there's an intruder in the house, isn't it? And he goes running into the kitchen. He's like rummaging through the kitchen drawer, trying to find the biggest knife that he can. He grabs hold of this knife, but he's still paralyzed. Like, he's completely just the fear. It's not paralyzed from the alien force. It's paralysis from the fear. But he still manages to kind of overcome this. And he runs into his living room and he says his brother and sister are there. And he's like, oh my God, did you see the thing? It's upstairs. And they seem to just be... they have no idea what's going on. It's like they knew something was up, but they didn't see this creature. They didn't see what had happened. They obviously saw their brother was extremely distressed, but they weren't really able to comprehend, you know, the situation that had just occurred. And it really does seem like this. It's like, and he highlights this in his book, because in the book, just to interject for a moment, he does include like all these other stories about, you know, what other people have experienced. I'll include one or two later. But he also includes a lot of classic cases that we already know, like the Antonio Villas-Boas case and, you know, those sorts of things. But he kind of ties in these connections where he's like, well, there's plenty of cases where for whatever reason, it seems like the intelligence behind the phenomenon is capable of hiding itself from other eyewitnesses that are standing in the exact same room as you.
Mm.
And this is not a hallucination. This is what's really important, because this is what some people from a skeptical standpoint, and in some circumstances they're right, will say that person's having a psychotic break. That person is experiencing a hallucination. They've accidentally consumed ergot for lunch. Those sorts of things. But this is repeated over and over again, where there's some type of physical evidence for what had taken place. And that will come up in a moment. But he's freaking out, and his brother and sister are like, no, you need to calm down. But he's like, no, some unknown force has deliberately orchestrated these events and I don't know what's going on. But they eventually calm down. He calms down. Obviously, his brother and sister calms down. The dog calms down. Everything's fine. However, in the early hours of that very morning, after the appearance of the little man in black, I suddenly found myself awake in the downstairs hall. Now, he says, I was floating on my back. I was hovering roughly 3 feet off the floor. That was my exact response. And some invisible force, which had defied my senses, began to move me on its own accord through the glass-paneled kitchen door.
Insertion imminent.
Well, you're not too far off the point there, Ben, because that's exactly what happens. He describes this shocking feeling of like a hot knife passing through butter as his body just goes out. And he says, someone or something was directing me into our garden head first. And this thought struck me as odd, because why on earth was I being guided outside? I'm thinking, that's a good point. Like, why would you float someone downstairs and then out through? Like, if you've got a UFO can then do that, why not just suck them straight out? Like, it doesn't make any sense, but none of this makes any sense. Like, it's done on purpose to cause confusion so people just don't really understand what's going on. But he says, as he's there and during this moment, there's all these questions that are kind of just going around in his head, but he's sure that this UFO phenomenon, it's a reality. And he says, this is when my attention was drawn to a stationary craft that was high up in the sky, and I found myself being lifted high up and being pulled with intent towards this dark and foreboding craft. Now, he also points out that right before this happened, when he looks up into the sky, because that's all he can do, there are craft everywhere. Everywhere, and all kinds of different shapes, and they're all flying around. Like, well, I would say hundreds, but lots of them. Like, lots of them, dozens, let's say. And they're flying around everywhere. But there's one, this dark one, got his attention. It's almost like...
diamond-shaped?
He doesn't say it's diamond-shaped, but it's just this dark and foreboding craft. And he's just pulled towards it. He's towards it. Now, he says, I awake once I'm kind of pulled through this craft somehow, pulled through the sky. I'm feeling confused. And the first thing that I notice, of course, is...
cold table, cold steel table.
I am strapped to a hard bed. Except in this circumstance, I was extremely hot and thirsty, but I couldn't move my arms and legs because I was strapped down. Alarmed, I also discovered that I was naked. I'm like, okay, so this is...
Is this where a hot blonde Pleiadian man unzips himself from a plastic bag?
No. But where you're going is definitely on point. We are heading in that direction. It will get a little bit anally in a moment. So he says, to my right direction, I can only describe three tall, muscular reptilians.
Oh.
Okay, like, yeah, it's a bit different. It's a bit different, right? He says, they were surrounded by a thick mist, but I could easily discern their shocking and somewhat harrowing look. There was a total lack of emotion coming from them that was abundantly clear. And another horror immediately became apparent as I studied these monsters, which appeared to now be swaying from left to right in some weird ritual. I discovered that there was something inside of me. I felt something organic pulsating within the lower regions of my anatomy.
Don't say pulsating,
please. It didn't take long for me to realize that a foreign implement had been inserted into my rectum and was seemingly being used for whatever purpose, right? He said, I'd awoken to this and I didn't know what it was. These beings were callous, cold, and above all, evil. To my mind, they had no wish in helping me, but rather they seemed to enjoy the plight that I was in. It's like, this is freaking nasty. Like, this is true. But I mean, to even write something like this, like I don't know this guy, and I've only read one of his other books, so I can't even really draw conclusions. But from reading this, I mean, I would say to make a claim that you have been violated like this, I think you'd have to be trying to be pretty genuine. Like, this is his lived experience, you know, and I don't usually use that term, but to even like publicize something like this, it's pretty brave of him to be like, yeah, I woke up on board a craft with a couple of reptilians shoving something up my butt.
Because all your friends are going to read it, your family's going to read it, your coworkers are probably going to read it.
Yep.
And you're going to be that guy.
You're going to be that guy. I mean, you're going to become the Whitley Strieber. You know,
and
it's like everyone.
Australians are going to make fun of you.
Well, that's probably is going to happen. But I'm not going to make fun. At least one Australian is going to make fun of you. Just stop.
Yes.
Well, so what I will interject with...
I fear you might be discovering something inside you.
No. What I found conflicting about him is that he highlights something that I do totally agree with. He's like, there's plenty of people out there that make out that this is good. There's good aliens, not this particular incident, but aliens are good and they're there to help us. I'm like, no, they're not. They're all assholes. They're all doing bad things. You know, it's not Stephen Greer stuff where it's all wonderful. And he's like, no, he's like, absolutely. These things are evil. These things seem to be getting some type of sexual pleasure out of doing this. And God knows what else it was there for.
Well, in all seriousness, that's the typical explanation that people report from these reptilian kind of entities is that, yeah, they enjoy the pain and the fear. Whereas the greys, they're always described as robots.
Well, they are. They are.
These guys are sadists. They love
them. They're sadists. They're masochists. They're truly horrible. And he said, you know, in his mind, he's like screaming out for help. And as he does, he said, in a flash, I felt the object being immediately retracted. He said, it looked as though this was done mechanically because nothing or no one had come to my aid in performing this procedure. I raised my head to see something like a snake moving off across the floor ahead of me. And disappearing into a wall, essentially. This device had been mechanical in nature.
Gross.
It's really gross. Like, it's really disgusting. So I agree with him. Like, this is evil. But then on the other side of the coin, like, later on, he starts hinting that, that this phenomenon, though, it's not what we think it is. You know, I'm in two minds about this, but perhaps, you know, we'll be able to work this out together.
What do we think it is?
what
is he implying we think it is?
Well, I won't say that just yet because that will give away his kind of, but it's very much, It's physical and non-physical at the same time. Like, what's happening to this guy? It appears to be, this is out of body. This, what's taking place right now is actually out of body. It's not physically happening, but then it seems to be physically happening at the same time. So he says, as all this is all occurring, he's just trying to comprehend what's taking place. He writes, I was presented with another spectacle ahead of me. This time it was a cream-colored gray. And he says this cream-colored gray was kind of like helping him. And it was like taking the straps off his, like he says, the straps are taken off his arms and legs. The gray doesn't want to help him. The gray is just like, okay, you have to get dressed. And he's like, what? And the being like, there, get your clothes. And his clothes are just like his night clothes. His pajamas are crumpled up on the ground. So he gets up and he goes and he dresses himself. And he suddenly finds himself being escorted by this cream-colored gray who is very cold. It has a complete blank expression on its face. He's upset because he's like, what the hell's happening to me? Where am I? And this gray kind of escorts him to the edge of the UFO, pretty much like a scene out of the, you know, a Simpsons Halloween special, where it pushes him out. It just like literally pushes him out. He says, I feel this push forward from an invisible hand behind me and I'm sent on my way. And I suddenly found myself floating out of the craft and descending to the garden below. Now, in the garden below, though, he's looking down and he can see that there's this craft, this much smaller craft that's kind of just hovering, like just next to his conservatory in the garden. And he notices that there's something else. He says, it's the Noddy creature.
What is the Noddy creature?
It's a 4 foot tall, pointy, gray creature, but it's got a Noddy hat on. You know, like the character by Enid Blyton, I think it is, like with a Noddy hat on. But this time he says it's wearing a one piece. Yeah, pretty much that. It's wearing a one piece khaki drill uniform with no pockets or insignia. It has no belt. It wore black knee length boots. And it had a pointed hat upon its head. Now, during this moment, he's like, what the hell am I looking at? It just seems like Noddy, but I've... And he goes also...
Screen memory?
Well, he's like, I felt like I'd seen this creature before, but where, I can't remember. But also, why is it so angry with me? Like, it's pissed off.
Huh?
It's really pissed off with him. And he says, at that moment, he's like, because he's like, why is this thing angry at me? I haven't done anything wrong.
Mm.
He's like, I just want to run up and punch this thing in the face. I'm like, I like this guy. I really like this guy. He says, Noddy, and he starts like yelling at this thing inside his mind, like screaming at this thing, asking these questions. And he writes that Noddy's expression changed to complete shock. It's as though he couldn't believe that I was asking such a question. His scowl disappeared and his attention was no longer focused on me. But he began to rasp some deep, mechanical, and unintelligible voice, which sounded like a voice synthesizer. Now, we've heard this in the Kiel reports. We've recently heard this in the episode we did on Telephone Calls from the Dead, where this voice in this high strangeness elements comes through, and it's got a mechanical or a computerized voice synthesizer tone to it that comes through. And he says it doesn't understand what it's saying. But then after that, like this takes place, he's hurled through the glass of the conservatory doors, like, but through it, like not actually smashing it. He's just passing through it, much like he did passing out. But he said this was odd because when he was escorted out, it was like they followed this very kind of precise way of oh my God, Ben, that's terrible. He just put an image up of Noddy dressed as a gray. I like the speed that you're able to do that,
yeah. Man.
But as he was pulled out of the house, it was like all these greys, all these helpers were involved. But this was the reverse. It's like pulling him back in. Now, he says, as he was thrown back into the house, he finds himself once again in his bedroom and he sees himself lying dead to the world in his bed.
Okay, so he was out of body.
He was definitely out of body. How could I be here and there at the same time? None of this makes any sense. And he says there was a crunch sound. And he immediately woke up in his bed with a start. You know, that like that jerk that you get when you're kind of falling asleep, but it reverse, like he gets this feeling. Immediately his nose starts to bleed and he had to rush to the bathroom to sort himself out. He said, I felt sore, violated, and slightly nauseous. I'm like, okay.
Well, this is something that UFO researchers have discussed and debated over the decades as to the physical nature of these experiences. And you know, many of this, there's been massive essays written on this. I was just reading one last week. The name of the author escapes me, but he was trying to come up with clear categories where you could discern in what experiences were the abductees out of body? In what experiences was it astral and non-physical? In what experiences can you clearly say it is physical? In many of the cases where women claim a fetus is, or, you know, something's implanted or a fetus is removed, That has to be physical.
It has to be physical.
That's got to be physical, right?
Yep.
But many of these other cases, yeah, the abductees returned. They see themselves in the bed. All of this explains how they go through the window, like how they come through the doors.
Of course it does. Yeah, absolutely.
They're not physical.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then, yeah, this raises the question of what's being abducted on, what's being manipulated. If you manipulate the astral body, the non-physical body of an individual, what does that do? I mean, what is that? How does that apply? If I take your astral body out and do something to it, does your physical body then reflect the changes eventually? What actually happens?
Bingo. I think you're right there. I think there's something about that. I don't know the exact mechanism, but these particular cases will highlight that. And it just occurred to me, right, because I'll describe this in a moment, but the cases of where women claim to have had faux pregnancies and these phantom pregnancies, this sort of stuff, there's been a couple of cases that I've read where women will have trouble conceiving. Like they'll go and seek assistance for fertility. And when they go and have, you know, fertility treatment, the doctor will say, oh, you've got scars in your uterus but they'll be surgical.
Yeah,
and of course,
had an abortion or something.
Yeah, you've had an abortion or you've had some type of, endometriosis treatment or something. And of course, the patient or the abductee was like, I've never sought medical assistance. I've never had an abortion. This doesn't make any sense. And yet they've got the physical scars. And that's exactly what happened to Kinsella, because when he came back and woke up and he's had this nosebleed, and he said these nosebleeds, they weren't just this one-off. He kept on having them after this, which is, first of all, if you just, your body, non-physical body is being abducted, why would you have nosebleeds after? Like, why would that be occurring? But it gets more intense than that, because he tells his brother everything that happened, and his brother was clearly, willing to listen to him. And he says to his brother, can you check for any strange marks on my body? Like, check my back. And his brother looks and he's like, no, I can't find it. Oh, hang on a second. And he says, incredibly, he found 3 red puncture marks in a perfect triangle behind my right ear. Okay.
Wait, so you're saying that he hasn't been physically taken,
but
like I suggested, any changes done to the non-physical body will appear on the physical body.
Yeah.
And I've actually heard that from people who claim to have their third eye open. There's an example of someone who their arm was paralyzed, but their arm was totally fine. Like, it wasn't bruised, it wasn't injured, the bones weren't broken, but they just had no mobility in their arm. And, doctors couldn't help them, physiotherapy couldn't help them, until they saw a psychic, and the psychic was like, well, yeah, your arm in another dimension is damaged.
Really?
And so you'll never be able to move your physical arm because your other arm is never going to work.
And how did that occur? Is there any details?
I don't know.
See, it's interesting because that reminds me of the whole phantom limb syndrome. And this is where we're talking about this idea of we call it the electrical scaffolding of the human body, but it's like you're supposed to have a certain spiritual scaffolding of your body that exists in another reality. It's in another space. And if that does get affected, like even though, let's say in this physical reality, you may lose an arm or lose a limb, that it's not removed in another reality. So what you just described is essentially the reverse of that taking place. But this is kind of what happened with this guy, with Kinsella. I think that he's had a non-physical experience, but it has very physical ramifications. And so what he did is he went and grabbed his brother went and grabbed his mother's Polaroid camera. And guess what happens? They try to take photographs of it, but every single photograph would not develop.
How do you explain that? Well, it just comes out blurry.
Doesn't develop properly. Like, it just comes out as you've seen a Polaroid when it starts to develop, and it just wouldn't develop beyond a certain point. He wasn't able to get any proof of it. He said the photographs would not come out. So because of this prompted him to contact a ufologist by the name of Jenny Randalls. So he contacts the noted researcher, Jenny Randalls. And, she's like, I want to talk to you and your brother. I want to know, what's going on. And immediately she's like, the fact that he says you're a twin, she's like, yeah, this is really interesting because there's a lot of identical twin cases going on. I'm not exactly sure how this relates to the phenomenon, but it does in some way. And he says, look, I assumed that any alien contact had to be negotiated on some physical level of reality. But yet the more I researched, the less I was inclined to believe that this was what was actually occurring. And up until this point, I'd also considered that aliens were friendly in nature. My bizarre intrusion, and what an intrusion it was anything but. And speaking of talking about this physical thing, it's like he came back, he was sore. And reading between the lines, I'm like, I know why he's sore. He's had this mechanical snake shoved in him. And he's like, how would these physical marks account for something that most people would say was nothing more than a mere hallucination?
It only hurts the first couple of times.
Oh, so later on, after the nosebleed, so, you know, that's separate, that kind of calmed down. He says, there was a problem with my right ear. He says, when I showered that morning, it felt as though something was blocked, and he ended up becoming...
Something's going to drop out, isn't it?
Well, it doesn't drop out. He ends up going and getting medical assistance because it's so irritating to him. It actually becomes irritating. He says, the doctor examines his canal and says, look, yeah, it's definitely red and sore, but, you know, there's a suggestion that maybe it's some type of, you know, an infection. You know, it's there's nothing in there. They can't find anything in there. And he keeps on going back and he's like, well, maybe these doctors or this particular GP is going to think that I'm crazy because I keep on going for a second opinion and they can't find anything. But there is this one time where he goes and they find something. They spend like 5 minutes or so, you know, spending a longer amount of time. And this doctor kind of goes, let me go get someone. So she wanders out and brings someone back in. I'm like, yeah, there's something in there, but it's so deep in there. It's like deep up in the canal that, you know, we'll have to come back and check it later. So he says that day he's lying on his bed taking a cat nap. And he says, I feel something foreign physically move in the canal.
Oh, no.
And he says, I immediately recognized the sensation. It appeared that the object was retracting deeper into his ear canal.
Because it heard the conversation.
Well, it's moving. Yeah. It knows somehow that he's onto it because he keeps on going back to these doctor's surgery. And I might have got the timeline mixed up a bit, but basically it knows what's going on. And this doctor says, yeah, there's some type of crystalline structure in there and it still appears to be healing. And he's like, what do you mean? Like, what does she mean crystalline structure and still healing? Like, none of this makes any sense. And the nurse, right, this is the irony of this kind of stuff. The nurse jokingly says, like completely jokingly says, have you been abducted by aliens? And for him, that was-
Why would you say that?
Maybe because she might have known, like, it's just very jokey. Very jokey. Yeah, yeah. Like, just not
classic.
Yeah. And he said, I was shocked. God forbid, you know, none of the doctors or staff at this particular practice knew anything about my interest in aliens or UFOs. But then she asked this question and he says, this is a powerful and overwhelming experience that categorically proved to me that something far stranger was occurring, something far stranger than I'd ever considered before. And then he realizes, like, oh, yeah, my childhood was kind of filled with experiences, like the appearance of a silver orb, which was also witnessed by their maternal grandmother, the emergence of high strangeness that started with him and Ronnie when he's no more than 4 years old. He writes that one of my earliest memories had been me lying on a bed one morning, struggling for a long time with an invisible force. Now, I won't read it out the quote directly, but essentially he had like a... throw, I suppose, is what we would call it. And the throw had like little tassels on the end of it. He says these things, almost like the carpet out of Aladdin in itself, was like, what would be the term, animated. And it was kind of like wrapping itself around him and like pushing him down and using the tassels at the end to kind of tightly grip his legs and push his legs down so that he was strapped down. And he said, I was a child. All I could do was cry for help. And this appeared to go on for a long time and no one came to help me. Like, it was a horrible experience. And he says at the time, being 4 years old, he thought it was a ghost. Like, he figured this was a ghost. But then later on, he says, and this is where we go back to the more typical MO style of experiences that abductees typically have. He says, I found myself outside this cottage where I was living. I was no longer in my bedroom in the early hours of the morning, having no idea how I got outside. There'd been this weird fog. And he says, in the weird fog, when he's trying to understand, like, how did I get outside and what's going on? He says that there was a presence that was standing to his left. And he says, I now realize that this creature appeared to be like a classic gray recorded in ufology. And there was a smell too. It was musty old books, right? So we know this. Like, I'm normally with the smell. It's like a sulfur kind of smell. But also it's been described in some of the abductee reports as being like a dank or a damp, mustardy, you know, what's the kind of smell? Like an old, you know, disgusting smell. He said, I also remember another strange occurrence. Once again, I found myself standing outside, but this time it was on the perimeter of a local wood. I was still in my pajamas. I could see that there was the cottage kind of just behind me. I don't know again how I got there, but it was an early sunny morning. But he said, just from my vantage point where I was standing, there's like all these fields and moors around, but there happens to be this stand of trees. And in the middle of the stand of trees is a yellow tractor. This is a yellow tractor just sitting there. It's motionless. There's no driver. And he's like, even as a young child, I thought, how strange for a tractor to be sitting in the middle of the wood. It's like someone would have had to have picked it up, carried it over the trees and dump it down in there. And I'm like, mate, you know, and I he doesn't say it, but I think he, like reading between the lines, he's suggesting that that ain't no tractor. Like this is some type of either screen memory.
Well, usually with memories like that, it's like, well, the tractor had these weird lights around it. Mm. There's some little detail that's off. Maybe it was just a tractor.
No, because he highlights this. He's like, that you couldn't have gotten a tractor in there.
Okay.
You know, like something has picked this thing up and put it in there. So the suggestion is here is it's not a tractor. It's a craft. He also writes, there have been countless times when after my mother had put us to bed, she would hear what she thought to be something running up and down the wooden floors of the room late at night. Now, she would get out of bed, obviously, because she thinks that her children were up. And of course, she'd go and look in their bedroom and to find them fast asleep. And she's like, later on, she's like, I didn't want to deal with any of this old rubbish. And she was just basically convinced that there had been a ghost in the house. But in light of what he's describing, I don't think this is a ghost. I think this is, and this again goes back to this weird contradiction between it seemingly being a very non-physical thing that's taking place, but with very physical elements to it. Like hearing the shuffling of feet or running of feet through the house, it just doesn't make any sense. He says there's also this weird thing that happened where it was like, he experienced some kind of time slip. He says he found himself once again outside this house. This house didn't have a history of hauntings, but it was an old house. Apparently, at one point, it had been occupied by the model Twiggy. And, so it was
what?
Twiggy. You know, Twiggy from the 60s? No? Okay.
Well, we'll have to do an image search.
You have to look up Twiggy. Yeah. She's a real stunner in the 60s. But
Twiggy.
Twiggy. Yeah. You had like in the 60s, you had the models, you had Twiggy, you had the shrimp. I can't remember the names of the other one, but they're all those names. But yeah, she lived in this place.
Twiggy and the shrimp.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that you know always shocks. Like I'll give some reference that's so mass mainstream pop culture, like Lord of the Rings, and you just look like a blank wallpaper, like no recollection at all. And then you'll be talking about Twiggy from the 1960s as if I'm meant to know this.
I don't even know how I know that.
Oh, core blimey, mate.
Well, that's not the 60s anymore.
Twiggy.
That's not the 60s anymore.
Core blimey.
But anyway, so this house was like quite a spectacular house, but you know, you would expect it to have some type of like history of haunting, but it didn't. But he says when he was in one of these fugue states that seemingly was induced by the phenomenon, we don't know if it's aliens, but that's kind of the idea. He says, I could see this enormous crumbling cathedral that was directly at the back of their cottage. Of course, no such cathedral existed, but perhaps it had in the past. Like maybe he was having some weird time slip.
That's weird.
That was and I, immediately, right, I start thinking, well, and even though we've had, you know, ancient structures, we were talking recently about Neolithic sites be built on certain places, but even cathedrals, like even places of worship have been built on certain locations because of their energy. And Kinsella later on in his book actually highlights this fact. He's like, location is key. But there's something going on here that connects to the location.
Really?
It's not just simply that it's, you know, you are targeted by the phenomenon and you have the experience. It also has to be combined with a location. Like, so, and this is basically like the Keel idea of a window area. And I think he's onto something. You know, because everything that it requires some type of energy. It's an energy that physics doesn't currently recognize and something that we certainly don't understand. But it seems to play a role in many of these encounters. Now, he says this property was called Bignall House. Sadly, they had to vacate the property at some point because they were emigrating to South Africa for 18 months. And he says it was at this point where something truly bizarre occurred. He says, I was 6 years old. And he says that his sister was being pushed in a pram and Ronnie was trailing behind on a path through the perimeter of this wooded area. And the trees to the sides and behind us were very tall, and something caught my and Ronnie's attention from behind it. It was, of all things, a huge bear.
Huh?
This is in the UK, okay? We're not in South Africa yet. This is still in the UK, just as they're about to leave. But he's like, but it wasn't a bear. The body was clasping at the top of these trees and swinging from left to right. Its face was not that of a bear, but something horrendously grotesque. It felt like we were being deliberately taunted by this creature. And he says, my brother remembers this event. It's Bigfoot.
What's he doing there?
He's the high strangeness of this stuff. It's like this kid is having these experiences of UFOs and now you've got this Bigfoot hanging around.
It's like he didn't want to be left out. There's all this weirdness going on. There's abductions, there's time slips, there's haunted houses.
And there's cryptids that show up. And so he's like, look, you know, this is might be funny when you talk to it, you know, talk to the family about it. And many of their other family members, they have no recollection of any of this, but Ronnie does. Like Ronnie does recall this stuff. And he says, look, you know, following on from this, you know, he eventually gets to the point where he's able to summon UFOs. Like many, many years later, he's able to summon UFOs. In fact, if you bring up some images here, Ben, I want to just to highlight a couple of things. Because speaking of Rendlesham. So first of all, this is a map he writes here that Dave Twine, sent him. And this was about a collection of reports that occurred on the 9th of April in 2016. And because obviously he's now in the UFO field and he's getting reports coming in, he's got connections. There was a collection of these UFOs that were witnessed across the UK.
So he's tracking the sightings and it looks like a straight line.
Well, they track the sightings, right? And he's like, yeah, absolutely, there's a straight line cutting across England. Now, later on, he's like, hang on a second. And if you just go to the next image, Ben, he's like, this sits perfectly along the St. Michael alignment or the Michael, I think it's Michael Mary, St. Mary.
Yeah, and you mentioned there's churches on along this line, and a lot of those churches were built on top of the old pre-Christian monuments.
Where they, this culture that built them, seemed to understand these energies and the importance of these locations. And so you just have, as recently as 2016, you have it kind of almost identically corresponding with that line. So, you know, people
and that's
have
Bruce Cathy's argument that these sources only can, they can only go on these grid lines, these energetic grid lines.
Yep. And see, people go, well, that's because that's how they're powered. It's like a train, you know, a train running along, you've got an electrical train, it has to, you know, use that. It may be a little bit different to that. It's like, yeah, that power might be something that plays a role here. But it also might simply be that these pathways offer connections, and this is just my speculation after reading his book, but offer connections into something known as the corridor.
So, okay, I was going to say, yeah, this is the corridor you were speaking
about. Well, the corridor is essentially an abstract concept, but it can be applied to these sorts of things. Let me just bring it up exactly for you because I've got a separate collection of notes here. So he says, and this is where how he ends it. I'll go back to his experiences, but I see what time running. But I'll just mention. So he essentially says the
Greys. You've got 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'll get through it. So he says the Greys, perhaps, the Greys have intercepted our eternal cosmic corridor of conscious thought. This is basically the psychic internet, so to speak. But it thus allows entry straight into the minds of any recipient. And this, I'm like, he's actually onto something here. Because this is like, gives us an answer to the whole non-physical, physical element going on.
How so? But
because it's like every single person, there is another reality. There's another layer of reality. And this might explain like this other, I mean, he's calling it the psychic internet. Mm. But this is why we have, you know, extraordinary knowing and telepathy and all this kind of stuff and precognitive dream. There's another space, another layer that's just above us, right? The Greys haven't gotten into the physical reality here. They've gotten into the layer that's above us. And he says, a person on a trip, for example, using drugs. And what happens? People use drugs. We were only just talking about it. They encounter strange alien-like entities, these strange forms. He says, perhaps the Greys have gotten in here. There's already a level. There's already, a reality of beings that already naturally inhabit that space.
Yes.
The Greys infiltrated it. They got in. So when you go and take drugs, you actually are entering into what is their physical reality. And abductions and Greys, he writes, I believe, have entered our world in this way. It's truly disturbing and horrific. It's a process that leaves no clues as to their origins. And this is why we don't have any physical proof or very little physical proof, because it's not occurring in this reality.
Yeah, it's a great theory. I mean, we don't know if any of this is true.
This is just his hypothesis.
It has been, we've discussed it on the show before, the origin is certainly extra dimensional, although they can operate in our physical reality.
Yes.
But, you know, we were talking about the technology being seeded earlier on in the show and the idea that our society is being pushed in a certain way to
The next level.
To set up the environment that is essentially theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one of the arguments with the technology we have that we're using right now, is that, yes, and I've said this on the show before, yes, we have this, I've got this physical MacBook Pro in front of me, but as we know, there is an astral there is a corresponding non-physical counterpart to this physical mechanical creation.
And
it's that non-physical counterpart that they control.
Yes.
Especially when it comes to our technology. They, as you said, they've infiltrated this dimension. This is one of the arguments, that they have total control of that other layer of existence that we haven't even discovered.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing. Like, so this is what's really disturbing about it. We talk about the Akashic records. You know, they're in it. They've like, so they've invaded this reality.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, they've invaded this reality. They've gotten into the, so this is, and I've always said it's about human beings. It's about us, right? There's something that they want from us. They are into our files.
Yeah.
They're rummaging through everything. And he writes, you know, Kinsella says here, the passage through our psyche proclaims access to enormous amounts of data for the Greys. And while there, they can find genealogical connections to past relatives and so forth. So this may also indicate why certain abductees find their alien interactions run through their family lines.
Ah, interesting idea.
I'm like, he's actually that's really a good, on
that's
to something.
Interesting.
Look, I find him to be a
so the Akashic Records, the idea is there's everything in there.
There's everything in there. Like everything
all, of history,
happened, all of every, history, all like, yeah, of the future, time is irrelevant.
Another dimension where there's an imprint of all that has been.
And all that will be.
And they can access
and it. They've now gotten into it. It's like they and he says.
Isn't there a librarian up there?
Well, he says, it's like a virus.
Shush them out.
He says that it's like a virus. Like, and he very early on realized that there's some viral element to this, something that you and I decided to discover. And I think, you know, I follow his journey like through as I was reading this book, and I strongly recommend you pick up this book. The only criticism I may have, and it's not a criticism, I'm not having a go at him, but through the book, he kind of hints at a couple of things. And he doesn't really go into greater detail about it, but then includes another a collection of well-known cases that if you're already in this field, you probably know about. So there's one I'll highlight for you, right? And I'm at a little bit of risk because it's a delicate territory, but I'm just going to repeat what he says. So what he points out, right, he just fleetingly makes this comment of like, look, clearly the guy has an implant of some kind. Like there's something going on. After that, like there's this crystalline structure in his head. He says nothing happened until after he got his booster shot, as in the COVID-19 vaccine booster.
What happened after that?
So he says, look, he's like, I'm not going to go into basically, I'm paraphrasing, but the yes or the no's about this. He says, for whatever reason, I had to travel. And because I had to travel, the only way I could, unfortunately, was I had to get these vaccines. And he said, I got my first shot and I got my second shot.
Fair enough.
Everything was fine, right? But he says, when I got my booster, he says he was overwhelmed with pain. Like it was horrible. It was absolutely horrific. And like now it's coming out that, yeah, a lot of people are reporting this. Like it's not some, you know, conspiracy theory cooker bullshit. Some people had truly horrific reactions to it. But he's like, this was different for him because after he had this pain, all this horror and everything, guess what happened? The implant was gone. It was gone. And he's like,
What does that imply?
Well, he says that, and he hints on this, and this kind of ties in with the program that we've described, right? That abductees, you know, Preston Dennett, who was a great researcher, you know, he highlights like on spontaneous alien healings. Like we've covered those great cases, you know, people have been shot with beams that, you know, heal them and all this kind of stuff. We've speculated that perhaps it's because they're looking after their genetic integrity, right? So he's like, I think they are looking after their asset. Like he's an abductee. He's an asset, right? And so maybe he's got to have a certain... Now, you know, one of the things that's come out about the vaccine, there's scientific studies to prove it. In some circumstances, it actually is altering people's DNA. There was a study that came out of Europe saying that people's liver DNA was altered as a result of these vaccines. He's like, is that what happened? Like they intervened? Like he had two shots, fine. Nothing at all. Then all of a sudden he's in extreme pain and I'm reading this going, oh, it must be a result of the booster. I don't know. Maybe they'd intervened to stop it doing something to him.
Mm.
And then they pulled out the implant so there was no evidence of it because it was already
so
close to it.
So to stop their plans, we should all go out and get boosters?
No, I'm not saying that. It demonstrates that they were able to intervene. They were able to intervene and do something to him which caused immense horrific pain for him. Now, maybe it is just simply a reaction and maybe he's just somehow taken that experience of that reaction and kind of applied
it
to this.
Yeah.
Could be nothing, but after a lifetime of experiences, you do have to question, is that what's going on with this guy? And it basically, yeah, he said, I had a flare-up of osteoporosis in my neck and right shoulder after this injection. It was the worst pain I've ever experienced. He says also though, and I forgot because I've got this in my notes here. He says also, on closer inspection, he says, I was shocked to discover rigid marks around this area. Ronnie, his twin brother, had the same identical marks. He says, after this, I realized that I could no longer sense the object in my right ear. I wonder if they had come to remove the foreign implement because of the COVID injections. I was willingly taken. He says, if this was the case, such a procedure would somehow damage the alien implant. And maybe that's what happened. Now, with these marks, he says these marks are consistent with him being essentially tied down or clamped down again.
Oh. So now, what's interesting about this guy is full recall. No regressions.
He says that right at the start of
Hidden, like no blocked memories. Is he seriously saying he's recalling everything?
Yep. He says, unlike other abductees, what's really strange for him is that he is absolutely able to recall this directly. It's like, and it's not just a vague memory. It's not just a sudden spontaneous recall. It's not a hypnosis. He's like, he's able to actively recall this. Now, we're running a bit long. When we come back in the plus section, I'm just going to briefly mention something else that happened to him that kind of suggested that there was something very physical to this reality. Last thing I'll do, what happened? So later on, as I said, like, he ended up becoming much like performing the Stephen Greer, like SETI kind of thing, where he could summon UFOs. Like somehow he'd made this connection where he could summon UFOs. But also what he did, he went to Rendlesham, right? This is where it comes back to Rendlesham. He went to the site of Rendlesham where allegedly one of these diamond-shaped craft showed up back in the 1980s. He says what he would do is he would go and take photographs and attempt to summon beings. So if you go to one of those images I included there, Ben, I think it's image number 4. If you bring it up.
Number four.
He says, this is an enhanced image of an apparent humanoid which appeared on my phone when investigating Rendlesham Forest along with its mysteries.
Enhanced.
Now, look, this is the problem. He's taken this photograph. If you can kind of make it out there, it's like half kind of materializing in our reality. He says it appears to be some type of...
Is it a Bigfoot?
No, he describes it more as being like a Native American, but it's not.
Let's examine that kind of the pixels
with like a headdress on it. But you're right. It actually looks more Bigfoot-esque, doesn't it? But he claims that this is what he experienced at the site of the Rendlesham landing,
really?
The Rendlesham contact. So
is this something he's seen or just something he's seen in his camera later?
He says it was in his camera later.
Yeah, so.
So, yeah. But look, this guy, like he claims as well, I mean, it could be a case of gang stalking, but it doesn't appear to be so. Like he appears to be extremely coherent. He's well-written. He's very good at expressing, you know, what's occurred to him. He says that, you know, after this, he's been harassed by helicopters, like white unmarked helicopters with no insignia have been hovering right above his house. He says we could clearly see the pilots. The helicopter was positioning its cockpit to face him directly so that he could see the pilots and they knew that they knew that kind of thing going on. It's like this intimidation tactic that's going on. This is when the 2016 phenomenon was occurring. It's all very strange. It's all very odd, but I certainly think that he's onto something. I don't know exactly what he's onto, but I like his idea that there is this kind of... It doesn't neatly wrap it up, but it does give us some understanding as to why there is this physical, non-physical elements that are occurring together. There's this synthesis of it because they've essentially gotten into us. Now, what's the next plan? Like, what's the next stage? Well, we could, you know, spend another 2-3 hours talking about that. But I think it's kind of along the lines of what you've suggested. It's like they've gotten into the space that's above us. Now they need to prepare us to get into this reality.
Yeah, it looks like he's certainly figured out a key aspect.
We need to fight back.
Maybe not the answer to the phenomenon, but it's something that has to be acknowledged, the non-physical nature of the origin of a lot of this stuff. Well, coming up after the break, we're going to be looking at some dirty frogs.
Oh.
In particular, this man, Stefan, the world's greatest art thief.
So is he doing like Mission Impossible style, sneaking into art galleries in the Louvre, trying to pull stuff out?
No.
How does he steal art then? How do you steal a $4 million piece?
Yeah, it's a great question. And a lot of his thievery is just like some of it's persistence and some of it is just pure skill. Like, for example, and I'll explain this coming up, he has to undo screws to get into cases, right? To get into like a plexiglass case. It's connected with screws. And so what he'll do is he'll be like, wait till no one's looking and be like, screw it, unscrew it a little bit. And then a guard will come by. Then he'll wait like 10 minutes. And then he'll screw it a little bit more. And then he gets one screw out. Takes him all day. He comes back a week later. he gets the next screw. And he just keeps doing this until finally, like, it's kind of like
perseverance pays off.
Shawshank Redemption, where he's chipping away at the wall, but he's taking the screws out of these cases. And then he comes back and he waits for a clear moment. He's like, yoink, and takes it. And yeah, we'll find out. I wouldn't say it's ingenious, but he really is. He is clever in how he gets his $2 billion haul, and he does have an accomplice.
Well, he's also unemployed, so he has a lot of time on his hands.
Exactly. Yeah, the art thief is coming up. I'm going to be looking at this book from Michael Finkel that is exclusive to our Plus extension. If you want to get access to the rest of the show, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. You get access to the big extensions we do every single Friday. And of course, as a Plus member, you get access to our entirely exclusive season, which comes out every Tuesday. So you're getting more than double the content when you sign up for Plus. Plus members also get a totally ad-free version of the show. And if you sign up for MU Max, you get access to our entire back catalogue going back to 2007 and perhaps earlier.
Get in while you can.
What does that mean?
I want to get rid of it.
You want to have
I want to burn it.
A little ritual.
I do. Yeah.
Just burn it all.
Just get rid of it. I don't know what's suddenly changing me.
Do explain how you burn MP3s. I would love to see you figure this out.
Oh, it's from a more occult kind of perspective. It'll all be like ritualistic. I'll just press the delete button, but beforehand, like a little light a little fire on my desk.
Get Hillary and she can bleach it. I know someone who knows someone.
Yeah, that'll work.
Sign up today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Help support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Plus extension, great to have you with us.